This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
20 years ago, the Berlin Wall fell, leaving the Bush and Clinton administrations with a geopolitical map that had to be completely redrawn. 12 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, a small group of terrorists hijacked commercial jets and flew them into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. In both cases, when the walls fell, Americans had to reconsider what kind of world they faced, what type of world they wanted, and how to manage it. A conference at the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs will take place next week to explore these ideas. We are honored to be joined live in studio with Melvin Leffler and Jeffrey LeGros, faculty associates with the Governing America in the Global Era program at the Miller Center of Public Affairs, and also organizers of the conference. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to be here.
Mel, let's start with you. Give us the details on the conference and sort of the backstory to what this is all about.
Well, we were thinking a couple of years ago about what we should be doing to commemorate one of the most defining episodes in international history. That was the crumbling of the Berlin Wall in November of 1989, and we knew the 20th anniversary was coming up. As we pondered what we should do to appropriately commemorate it, we came to the view that rather than simply celebrating the wall coming down, which many, many other conferences are doing, and which is totally justified, nonetheless, we wanted to do something that was more analytic and more suggestive about the problems that policymakers and government always face. So the key problem was the wall came down. It was a wonderful and unanticipated event. But then it confronted government officials with the challenge, what to do now. This was a landscape, an international landscape, that government officials had not anticipated at all. So they confronted the problem that policymakers face from time to time. That is, what to do in an uncertain, ambiguous environment when actually there are huge numbers of opportunities, but also lots of conflicting priorities. So the key challenge is, how do policymakers make strategic plans, and how do they make policy in this type of a new and unprecedented situation? How do they define threats? How do they determine interests? How do they assign priorities to goals? And how do they interact? How do policymakers actually interact with one another?
And it's a fascinating subject, because as much as the West wanted to see that wall come down, and people on the other side of the wall as well, arguably, we didn't have plans for when it did. And surprising that it was so unexpected.
That's entirely correct. And although a few people in the spring of 1989 and the summer of 1989, one of our participants in the conference in particular, Philip Zelikow, has argued that within the administration, there were a couple of people thinking about the wall coming down and German reunification. The evidence suggests that virtually nobody was thinking that. And indeed, nobody really was thinking that in terms of the people who wound up overthrowing and shattering the wall. That is, when the event, you know, when people heard on radio unexpectedly on November 9th, 1989, that yes, East Germans were free to travel. They started gathering at the wall. They hadn't anticipated that they would be free to travel, to move from East Berlin essentially to West Berlin. And indeed, the people making the announcement had not anticipated that, in fact, they would be free to travel. And so you have a totally, you know, unplanned event that actually transforms history. And then policymakers everywhere, Moscow, Paris, London, Washington, have to deal with that.
They've all got to scramble to figure out, okay, what now? It's a totally new world.
Yeah. And my colleague Jeff LeGros here, said to me when we started talking about planning for this conference, these are great ideas, but why don't we compare it to another earth-shaking event that nobody really anticipated, and that was the attack on 9/11 2001. Also, a totally unexpected event that presented policymakers with challenges that they never anticipated, and with a suddenly transformed world, one that they had not really thought existed, but suddenly, because of the peril they perceived, becomes omnipresent. That is a world of terrorism.
We are honored to be talking with Melvin Loeffler and Jeffrey LeGros of the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs. They're with the Governing America in the Global Era program and organizers of a conference at the university next Sunday and Monday, When Walls Came Down, Berlin 9/11, and U.S. Strategy in Uncertain Times. And Mel, real quick, is this open to the public?
Yes, it is. Sunday night at 6 p.m., Robert Zoellick, the current president of the World Bank, who was a key policymaker in both those administrations, 1989 and then in 2001, 2000, to 2007. He's now president of the World Bank. Robert Zoellick will open the conference on Sunday night at 6 p.m. and then all day on Mondays at the Miller Center starting at 9 a.m.
Good deal. So, Jeff, give us your take on this conference, what you're looking forward to, and the goals of the conference next week.
Well, I think the key point is that we're gonna be perusing through history, but it's with a very current purpose. That is, when we look out in the world today, we're still facing this immense uncertainty about what to do with an incredibly complex and transformed world, one where we have to deal with nuclear weapons, terrorism, climate control, disease, and the list goes on. And what we want to do is go back and say, well, how did these guys handle this uncertainty? Because we still have to do it today, and we're still, in essence, in the wake of the collapse of the wall and of the walls in terms of both Berlin and 9/11.
Yeah, that's an important point. The people in power today are still grappling with these two events and what to do about them.
It's the same issues, and it's not clear we're doing any better. So our idea was, let's go back and look. How did we do? Did we get it right? And that's really what's intriguing. And this is just an exceptional set of policymakers. On Monday morning, Paul Wolfowitz is going to speak. He, of course, was in the Defense Department in the first Bush administration and the second Bush administration. We're going to have a set of scholars that are just exceptional in terms of covering different parts of the world and areas of politics.
And looking at the list, these are some of the best from all over America.
They're very good. Yeah. And we'll talk a little bit about what they're doing. And then we've got other policymakers like Eric Edelman, who served in both Bush administrations, Philip Zoellick, who served in both Bush administrations, and Walter Slocum from the Clinton administration, who can speak to how policy was carried out in the Clinton years.
Jeff, can you tell us what's different now? Because administrations in presidential history and leaders throughout human history have had to deal with big unexpected events. What makes it different in this day and age? Is it just the global reach of these kind of events?
Well, I think it's not the unexpected events, right? We're not trying to explain why the events happened. What we're trying to look at is, what did they do after as they looked forward? They had immediate tasks. In each case, they had immediate tasks that they had to deal with: reunification, dealing with the Soviet Union that was falling apart. After 9/11, you had to deal with this problem in Afghanistan and how to conduct this broader competition with terrorism. But they also had to think about, what is this new world we're in? It's no longer a bipolar world in the Cold War. It's a different kind of world. What should be our role in that world? What should be our attitude towards international institutions? Where should we position our defense forces? Traditional big power threats, or should we be dealing with these smaller counterinsurgencies? These are the same type of questions we deal with today. Are we planning well? Are we handling both the short and long-term issues well? That's really what we're going to be talking about.
We're talking with Melvin Loeffler and Jeffrey LeGros of the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs. You can learn more online about this conference and all the events and activities at the Miller Center at millercenter.org. So, Jeff, before we talk about some of the history, tell us a little bit more about some of the people who are coming. next week and who folks can hear from and talk with.
So some of our scholars who are coming are Adarne Westad is a well-known historian of global history, really, but he'll be talking a little bit about the lessons learned from the Cold War and dealing with third world conflicts in the Cold War and how they've been used to deal with events after 9/11. John Mueller, a well-known political scientist from Ohio State, is going to talk about the way that threats get inflated and have been inflated and the way that drives our national security planning. Very provocative paper. We're really looking forward to seeing how the policymakers handle those critiques.
Interesting.
Who else do we have? Mel?
Well, Bruce Cummings will be here. He's the chairman of the History Department at the University of Chicago, and he's one of the country's most eminent experts on Korea, particularly North Korea. Of course, he writes about many other issues as well, but he's long been a critic of the way the administration has, various administrations have dealt with the issues of North Korea atomic policy. And he's also been a critic of the assumptions that policymakers make about the evolution of politics inside North Korea. So he's a very provocative, incisive historian who has written extensively about North Korea and the Northeast Asian political economy. Then we have Mary Sarati coming, who's a professor of history at the University of Southern California. She's just written arguably the best book on 1989 and the fall of the Berlin Wall, and she will investigate how various key players in the international system reacted to the wall coming down. So she's going to be able to compare the way the West Germans reacted to this, the way the French reacted, the way the British reacted, how the Americans reacted, how Gorbachev reacted, and also provide some analysis of what sorts of opportunities were grasped and what sorts of opportunities were missed.
And our final academic participant is Bill Wolforth from Dartmouth, really bright guy, has been one of the leading scholars of unipolarity. And he's taking a different tack. He's going to look at academic predictions and analyses and see how they did relative to the government officials to say, did these guys do better?
I like it.
I don't want to give away the final score, but I'm rooting for the academics, and I'm not hopeful.
We're talking with Melvin Leffler and Jeffrey LeGros of the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Before we go to a break, and we're going to spend the rest of this hour now talking about a little history, so let's get started. Before we go to a break, Mel, I want to play a clip from you. We'll go back to just before the fall of the Berlin Wall, and this was President Ronald Reagan at the Brandenburg Gate, June 12th, 1987.
We welcome change and openness, for we believe that freedom and security go together, that the advance of human liberty can only strengthen the cause of world peace. There is one sign the Soviets can make that would be unmistakable, that would advance dramatically the cause of freedom and peace. General Secretary Gorbachev, if you seek peace, if you seek prosperity for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, if you seek liberalization, come here to this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, open this gate. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
June 12th, 1987. Melvin Leffler and Jeffrey LeGros are live in studio. So, Mel, Was that the fait accompli? I mean, is that what did it? What was the impact of his remarks, President Reagan's remarks there in 87?
What's so fascinating about this speech is that it has become one of the most iconic public addresses of the late 20th century and of certainly of the entire Cold War. That is, you hear this quote again and again and again. Nonetheless, the facts of the matter are that this speech had virtually no impact at the time and did not receive even much publicity in American newspapers and periodicals. It was shown on nightly TV that night, and it did have that impact. But what's curious is I went back and re-examined what was the public reaction. Was it on the front page of the New York Times? It wasn't even, as I recall, on the front page of the New York Times. It wasn't on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And there was no follow-up. There was no follow-up in terms of policymaking because Reagan wanted to make the speech, but none of his associates in the policymaking community, including Secretary of State George Shultz, thought that this was a moment when you could really pursue German reunification.
It's incredibly ironic how history is to us sometimes looking back.
That's right. So the speech actually had no impact whatsoever at the time.
Amazing. Amazing. But yet when we look back now, we think, well, Reagan stood up and said, tear down the wall, and well, it was just a few months later that they did it. You know, Reagan brought down the Soviet Union.
Right. And what we have learned, both from documents from the Soviet Union and even more importantly from documents from Poland and Hungary and East Germany, is that there were very complicated processes and developments going on within the societies and economies of all the Eastern European countries, so that the American role in the destruction of the Berlin Wall is a secondary role. It's important. It creates the framework because of containment policies, created the framework for the entire Cold War policies. But real agency is almost universally perceived as being within East Germany, amongst Eastern Europeans. And of course, Gorbachev's willingness to allow the dynamic of events leading up to the destruction of the wall in East Germany to occur. That is, Gorbachev allowed an enormous amount of change, not only inside Poland and inside Hungary, but also nurtured and supported change inside East Germany that ultimately took on a dynamic that neither he nor anyone else foresaw, but that he allowed those preceding developments to occur.
Let me ask you really quick before we break for news here at the bottom of the hour. Would that kind of change take place in today's environment with the current leadership in Russia?
Well, I mean, Russia today has, you know, no sort of domination over, you know, Eastern Europe.
So it's hard to draw parallels.
But certainly Putin is not a person like Gorbachev who is susceptible to wanting that type of dramatic change. He's much more concerned with stability and order than he is with change, especially the type of dynamic change Gorbachev was trying to nurture.
Yeah, Putin's not spending his time in Helsinki talking to West Europeans. He's spending his time in Beijing talking to them about how a one-party state can control the country.
We're talking with Melvin Leffler and Jeffrey LeGros of the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs. We're going to take a break for a few minutes for local news and weather and continue this conversation on the other side. When we get back, George Bush, the New World Order, and 9/11. Coming up next week, a conference at the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs, When Walls Came Down, Berlin, 9/11, and U.S. Strategy in Uncertain Times. We're honored to be talking live in studio with the organizers of the conference, Melvin Leffler and Jeffrey LeGros. Jeff, let me ask you, we were just talking a few minutes ago about the fall of the Berlin Wall. What was the immediate reaction afterwards? I'm curious what the American government specifically, what were the guys in Washington focused on as that was happening?
Yeah, a lot of it was fly by their pants, seat of the pants, and tactical planning. But they pretty much quickly settled on a deal with Germany to push for reunification and to push to embed the reunified Germany within NATO. And what followed in the months and a couple of years after that was some very skillful diplomacy that, in fact, made that plan a reality. So it was, I would say, a success for U.S. diplomacy.
Yeah.
But then they had to begin to think about a broader world order, and what really brought that on was the first Iraq War.
Yeah, the first Gulf War under George H.W. Bush. And let's hear from him, George H.W. Bush, addressing a joint session of Congress on the end of the Gulf War. This is from March 6, 1991.
The consequences of the conflict in the Gulf reach far beyond the confines of the Middle East. Twice before in this century, an entire world was convulsed by war. Twice this century, out of the horrors of war, hope emerged for enduring peace. Twice before, those hopes proved to be a distant dream beyond the grasp of man. Until now, the world we've known has been a world divided, a world of barbed wire and concrete block, conflict, Cold War. Now we can see a new world coming into view, a world in which there is a very real prospect of a new world order. In the words of Winston Churchill, a world order in which the principles of justice and fair play protect the weak against the strong.
President George H.W. Bush, March 6, 1991, speaking before a joint session of Congress. We're talking with Melvin Leffler and Jeffrey LeGros of the University of Virginia. So there's the new world order. Conspiracy theorists went nuts after that. What was the reaction? Where did that come from?
Well, I mean, it was really interesting because it really came from the way they conducted the Iraq War. And all through the conduct of that war, they were aware that they were setting precedents for how world politics might be conducted in the future. So, for example, when they were considering the invasion of Kuwait and liberating Kuwait, they were thinking, we have to go to the UN, and it's important to get this UN approval because that's the kind of world we want of a major power that is exercising leadership, but exercising leadership within a world community. So they came out of it and they said, you know, when we go in there, we also we need cooperation from Russia, from Soviet, from the new the follow-on to the Soviet Union, and instead of being conflictual with them, we're going to work with them together on this invasion. So it was an image of a United States that is a large power, but a large power that is respectful of the norms of international life and respectful of, as he says, weaker powers. That would be a model going forward in the future, laying down tracks for the U.S. To pursue in the years after that.
And surprisingly, Mel, surprisingly, respect for the United Nations, which we arguably we didn't see it from his son when we saw the Bush Doctrine.
Well, that's totally true, but Bush 41, the older Bush, was very much committed to alliances and to multilateral collaboration. And one of the key attributes of the Persian Gulf War was Bush's ability to put together a huge international coalition. And he has, you know, deserved great credit for bringing together so many nations in this coalition, and most particularly bringing in the new Russia, which was critical to the new form of collaboration. And of course, George H.W. Bush, his commitment here was to restore the international legal order. That is to say, to underscore the fact that military aggression will not be allowed. Territorial integrity must be respected. This is a fundamental component of the new world order that he had in mind.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ironies of it, one of the other parts where they were very conscious of setting precedents was in not going to Baghdad. So after they'd liberated Kuwait and whacked the Iraqi army, they had a clear path into Baghdad. But there was some resistance to that from other parts of the international community. And they thought, well, one of the reasons, there were other reasons as well, they didn't know what they were going to do with an Iraq that they were in charge of at that time. But one of the reasons was, you know, this will show restraint, you know, that we don't just pursue our power to its very ends. And this is going to be take into account this opinion. And it's an image of a restrained power that can do something but doesn't. And of course, that's one of the contentious decisions that cause problems farther down the road. Yeah. Might we have avoided these problems and the second invasion of Iraq had they pursued that?
So all of this, of course, is wrapped up in the phrase the New World Order, George H.W. Bush.
Exactly.
Very interesting. Let's now go to a clip a few years after that from June 12th, 1994. This is President Clinton speaking at the Brandenburg Gate, where President Reagan had spoken back in 1987.
We stand together where Europe's heart was cut in half, and we celebrate unity. We stand where crude walls of concrete separated mother from child, and we meet as one family. We stand where those who sought a new life instead found death, and we rejoice in renewal. Berliners, you have won your long struggle. You have proved. You have proved that no wall can forever contain the mighty power of freedom.
That's President Clinton on the anniversary of Ronald Reagan's remarks back in 1987 when he challenged Gorbachev to tear down that wall. Mel, I'm curious what you think of when you hear that clip.
Well, I think of the fact that during this period of time in the middle 1990s, both Republicans and Democrats alike, both George H.W. Bush and Bill Clinton, were extraordinarily tempted to celebrate what they perceived and what they argued was the inexorable march of freedom and democracy. That is to say, all nations now would embrace essentially the American way of life and American values, and that it would have universal appeal for everybody.
How about you, Jeff?
Well, it's at a point in the administration, I believe, where they're very really pursuing NATO enlargement, right? And it's the notion we're going to keep pushing NATO to the east, encompassing these countries that were formerly in the Soviet Russian sphere of
And they were successful influence. At that.
And they were successful, but there was a price to be paid as well, which was resentment and anger in Russia and a perception that we had violated a prior pledge not to expand into that area with NATO.
And anger is still there today.
And
right?
that resentment is still extremely strong today. That's correct.
We're talking with Melvin Loeffler and Jeffrey LeGros. Let's hear another clip now. We were just talking about him earlier. Here is 43, President George Bush.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world by seeking weapons of mass destruction. These regimes pose a grave and growing danger. They could provide these arms to terrorists, giving them the means to match their hatred. They could attack our allies or attempt to blackmail the United States. In any of these cases, the price of indifference would be catastrophic. We will work closely with our coalition to deny terrorists and their state sponsors the materials, technology, and expertise to make and deliver weapons of mass destruction. We will develop and deploy effective missile defenses to protect America and our allies from sudden attack.
President George Bush, State of the Union Address, January 29, 2002, the Axis of Evil clip. And this, of course, in the wake of the fall of some other walls in New York and Washington on 9/11. Mel?
Right. What's so interesting about the speech in relationship to thinking about the Berlin Wall coming down 12 or 15 years before, in 1989, is that in the earlier situation, 1989, the situation is full of opportunity. Policymakers are trying to seize opportunities as they perceive them and design policies accordingly. What's so striking about George W. Bush's speech is, of course, the framework is totally different. The framework now is peril. The framework is threat. No longer do you see policymaking thinking that the world is one of opportunity, that you can remake and reshape the world easily, given the great triumph of the Cold War. But now you see that the world is enveloped by terrorists, threats, and dangers that we could not possibly have imagined. When you reflect on it, one of the big issues that emerges then is, how come the folks making policy after the Berlin Wall came down weren't prescient enough to envision the prospective threat of terrorism that manifests itself on September 11th, 2001. That's one of the issues we want to grapple with. That is to say, should planners have, in the 1990s, after the Berlin Wall comes down and there's this great opportunity to remake the world, did their emphasis on certain issues like globalization mean that they underestimated the importance of other things, the emerging terrorist threat that, of course, beleaguered the United States and accounted for the walls coming down on 9/11?
Yeah, it's a horrible metaphor, but if terrorism is a souffle or a cake in the oven, the buzzer was going off for a long time and that thing was burning, and, you know, for a long time before the stove exploded, Jeff. I mean, it's like they were walking back and forth in front of the stove saying, huh, is something cooking? I don't know.
Right. But, I mean, the explosion of the souffle was the thing that was unforeseen. You know, maybe the souffle collapsing, maybe it not tasting as well, right? That's what they were anticipating, that terrorism was a threat, but it was a lower priority threat than perhaps the emergence of new great power challenges or, you know, some type of major conflict that would challenge U.S. Military forces in the old way.
And is that the anxiety of influence that we were under for the last few decades, that that's what a threat was?
No, that's exactly right. Yeah. But the debate continues today, which is, you know, do we reorient our military all towards fighting these, you know, local conflicts, counterinsurgencies, or do we need to be preparing for future challenges from a country like China or Japan? So it's not easy to walk through that door and say, oh, it's really not about states anymore, right? The axis of evil is about states. Notice, right, that it's about things we're used to dealing with and that are truly threatening. So the question is do you then downgrade these traditional state threats and upgrade these other ones? Well, 9/11 says yes, but maybe 9/11 was just a fluke. So these are kind of the issues we're going to press them on.
These and other topics you can enjoy next week at the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs. The conference is When the Walls Came Down, Berlin 9/11 and U.S. Strategy in Uncertain Times. You can get complete information online at millercenter.org. We've been honored to have been joined live in studio with Melvin Leffler and Jeffrey LeGros, the organizers of the conference at the Miller Center. Guys, thank you for being here. It's fantastic stuff.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.